Welcome, dear listeners, to today's segment of Afternoon Satsang. We shall be continuing with the Bhagavata Vahini, and last fortnight we went through a very beautiful, liberating kind of episode, which shows us that once we have God by our side, we don't need anything else. Nothing else matters. Having God is all that matters. That was what was discovered by Draupadi and the Pandavas as Bhagwan Krishna saved them from embarrassment and the fury of sage Durvasa. Last week we concluded with that episode of Durvasa with a discourse clipping where Bhagwan mentions how Durvasa's anger also is a divine tool that is necessary to be used in this drama called life. So, along with that, Bhagwan also narrated another episode where Durvasa's anger was used as a tool to save the Pandavas from the greed, vengeance and anger of the Kauravas. So, with this attitude, when we look at the whole of life, we realize that all the emotions, all the happenings, good and bad, happy and sad, everything happen with the blessings and the direction of the master planner Bhagwan. And once we have Bhagwan on our side, we need not have any kind of fear or worry. Surrender to him and be free. That is the message I think we'll get, which will get reinforced again and again in the Bhagavata Vahini. As we go through it today, we begin by offering our humble pranams at the lotus feet of our beloved Bhagwan. With me as always is Brother Prem, and we shall go into the Bhagavata Vahini, into an interesting episode where the devotee is forced to fight the Lord. This is another interesting episode, and I'm sure, like always, we will have many lessons to learn, many inspirations to gain from it. So, Sai Ram Prem, and it's wonderful joy to be sitting here and talking about our Lord.
Sai Ram Arvind, and you know, whenever you talk about Bhagavatam, the quality of devotion which it stands for is the first of the Navveda Bhakti, Shravanam. You know, and Parikshit has always given us an example of a devotee who attained the ultimate state through the act of Shravanam, or just listening. And whom did he listen to? He heard about the stories of the Lord, but whom did he listen to it from? He heard it from a sage. You know, a sage is supposed to be a man who has ascended to the level of a saint. Right? That is what is a definition of a sage, one who is a perfected human being. In just hearing it from a perfected human being, he attains the ultimate. But come to think of it, we are listening to it as a narration by the Lord himself. You know, Vyasa's son narrates the whole thing to Parikshit and he attains the ultimate. But here we are, Swami himself has penned this down. And when we say pen this down, well, it's important to, I mean, we can never overstate the importance of reading what Swami has written. Because whenever we talk of an avatar, we are talking about God coming down and spending time in the human realm. And that time is converted into a concrete work in the form of a book. And we have spoken about this many times before, in what conditions Swami would sit and write. You know, Swami would have so much work as a physical administrator of the ashram. There was construction happening all through the 70s and 60s. Swami was traveling. There was things happening in Vrindavan. The colleges were being set up. And so many other activities were happening. In the midst of all this, Swami would somehow find time to sit and write articles, which eventually became the Vahini series. And, you know, what joy it is to go back to that, to have the ability to go back to that even after so many years.
Absolutely. And that is, I think, an honor, privilege and responsibility. I would like to add on to the thought that you expressed about we having to go to the direct source and reading it ourselves. I've noticed this multiple times. You know, there will be a discourse of Bhagwan, either which we hear or we read in the Satsai Speaks or online. Now get three people to read the same discourse and ask each of them what the discourse stood for, and most likely you will get three differing answers. And when you wonder whether all of them read the same discourse or not, you get to know that each person takes home a lesson or an inspiration that he or she most needs from that particular discourse. And the same particular discourse has this ability of omnifelicity. Interestingly, this term omnifelicity was coined by, I think, Professor V.K. Gokak. To add on to the three qualities of Bhagwan, of omnipresence, omniscience and omnipotence, he said Bhagwan has the ability of omnifelicity. And I think he got inspired when he saw Swami raising his hand in blessing, and 100 others raised their hands to receive his blessings. And each one feels that this blessing is coming specifically only to me. Swami sent it to me. That kind of personalized blessing each one feels. And like this, 100, 1,000 feel like that. That is exactly what is happening through Bhagwan's writings as well. It is not just his physical form. As we read Bhagwan's discourse, it is amazing how each one of us gets an inspiration and an answer that we have been searching for, which might be totally different from the problem or a thing that is bothering somebody else. And that is the reason why it makes a lot of difference to read it ourselves rather than hear to us over an afternoon satsang. Of course, it is good to listen to it in an afternoon satsang, but you will be able to receive only that part which has resonated with my heart. And probably there are so many other things, not probably, definitely there are so many other things in Bhagwan's writing which will make your heart resonate with it. You are missing out that whole gamut being satisfied with only that part which has resonated with my heart. Because even among the two of us as we speak, I will see that suddenly you bring up a point which I have not even made notes about, you know. Because when I read it, I just felt, okay, it's a casual point, maybe mention or not mention, it doesn't make a difference. But for you, that is like the key point in that whole reading. And the same vice versa also happens. So that is why I would like to add on and stress further to what you said, that it is so important that we ourselves go and receive Bhagwan's words directly, either through his discourse or through the text.
Absolutely. In fact, some of the listeners who wrote to us after the Ramkatha Raswaini series, I think what we would probably appreciate as the best feedback is people who wrote to us saying that we were inspired to go back and read the Ramkatha Raswaini again. Though we have read it earlier, we thought we should reread it, and that's what we did. And I think that is probably the best appreciation that we could have, if people said that after listening to you, we went and read the book again. Because it's not about listening to us, it's not about getting it from us. That would still be probably, you know, I think lower than getting it from somebody like Shuka. I mean, not probably, it is. You know, we are not even as perfect as the sages of the yore in that sense. But if after listening to this you are inspired to go and read it, and the important thing, I think we mentioned this even when we were speaking about Ramkatha Raswaini, these are not books that you read once and then you tick it off and you say that this is done. These are books that you have to reread again and again, because the epics themselves are like that. Because your understanding of the epic grows with you. At different stages of life you have to take the same book. I mean, how many times probably we would have read the Ramayana? As students, if we had read the Ramayana, would we have understood the role that Rama played as a householder, the importance of the role that he played as a husband, the sensitivities that he portrayed in that role? As a school-going student, if you read the Ramayana, you would have never been able to resonate with that. But now when we read it, you know that these are responsibilities that a man who is 30 years or 35 years has to be sensitive to. So in that sense, all of these epics grow with us, or rather, when we read them again and again, our understanding grows as we grow, and that is why it's very, very important to reread them.
So coming to today's episode, Vyasa has completed narrating to Parikshit the story of how Durvasa is sent by Duryodhana to, you know, humiliate and curse the Pandavas, but the episode concludes with Durvasa blessing the very same Pandavas and actually cursing Kauravas indirectly by saying that those who had such evil intentions on you, they will be destroyed in due course of time. That is how he pronounces a general curse, but all of us know that it is definitely going to be directed onto the Kauravas. So as Vyasa tells this, he says that all this becomes possible only because the Pandavas were ready to do anything for God. They were ready to sacrifice anything for God. Because, you know, speaking of sacrificing for God, it's a myth to say sacrifice for God. Because as we have repeated over and over again, a sacrifice is when you give up something of greater value for something of lesser value. Not vice versa. When you are giving up something of a lesser value for God, who is the ultimate greatest value in this universe, it can never be called a sacrifice. At best, it can be called an intelligent profiteering, you know, because that is what the Pandavas did. And in fact, Vyasa tells that the Pandavas were ready to do anything for the Lord, even fight with God himself. That is what Vyasa says. And this piques the interest of Parikshit. He says, you mean my forefathers, they have fought with God? I would love to listen to that story. And when I was reading this part, what struck me was, this is a very unique sadhana going on. We spoke of Shravanam and Kirtanam. Here it is Kirtanam and Shravanam going on together at the same time. And I feel when the sadhaka who is practicing Kirtanam, here it's of course not the sadhaka, it's Vyasa. And here there is a sadhaka who is practicing Shravanam, that is Parikshit here. When both of them are pure and good, each reinforces the other, you know. Vyasa, we have seen many fortnights before how he is very reluctant actually to even speak. He has just come on a visit. But the eagerness and enthusiasm of the Shravanam Sadhaka, which is Parikshit, makes him divulge more and more. And we have seen that it's going on and on so much so that our listeners may wonder whether Swami's Bhagavatam is going to be entirely narrated by Vyasa himself, or is Shuka ever going to make an entry. That many stories. And at the same time, Parikshit is also thirsting, you know, he's thirsting. And he's also finding fulfillment in listening to the way Vyasa narrates it. So, I feel this is a great blessing if we are able to find this kind of constructive build-up, you know, between the two sadhanas, Shravanam and Kirtanam. And the most beautiful example we are seeing here, happening between Vyasa and Parikshit. So Parikshit asks, I would love to know that story. And Vyasa then says, you know, okay, I will tell you one more, because there's going to be no end. Not hours, not weeks, not months, years also will not suffice to tell you about all the glories of grace of Bhagwan Krishna on the Pandavas. But since you asked this particular one, I shall start narrating this.
And in the process, he narrates this incident which happens probably at the end of the Vanavasa, or, you know, even during the Vanavasa, what happens, I mean, that's an interesting thing, because here is somebody who is Lord Krishna, who is trying to push them towards a peaceful conclusion to this standoff between the brothers. But even through the process, I think Krishna is giving them hint that you have to be prepared for whatever comes. You know, if there's going to be a war, you can't be found wanting. So in that sense, when Dharmaja shows a lot of concern, as you know, is this going to have a good end? Because, you know, once you have seen the intentions of the Kauravas, you know that at the end of 12 years, they're going to come up with something. You know for sure that they're not going to hand back your kingdom and then they say that let's live in amity after this. So Dharmaja is concerned, and that is when Arjuna says that he will try to acquire some weapons. He's an ace archer nonetheless, but if there is a battle, you know, you need to have a little bit of edge over your opponents. So he says, in that, I will go and acquire some fresh weapons. And these are nothing but, you know, as somebody beautifully put it, it's voice-activated missiles, if you have to explain it in modern parlance. You know, these are special weapons which are activated when a certain mantra is, propitiated or is chanted, but with the blessings of the deity that mantra propitiates. So it's not like anybody who chants that mantra can access that weapon. That deity himself gives you that weapon, and then you chant that mantra which goes with the weapon, and it has a particular effect.
I think years ago when we were told about all these mantras, those of us who had this scientific bent of mind would wonder, how is that happening and how can you just say something and it happens. I think in a very primitive form, we are already seeing it when we have Siri and other voice assisted, Google also, you know, Google Voice, where you just speak out and say, find out about this, guide me to the nearest restaurant, and you're guided to the nearest restaurant. I think 15 years back, if somebody had told you, just tell out to a piece of electronic equipment in your hand, take me to the nearest restaurant, and it'll guide you perfectly.
And now we are talking about self-driving cars, which means you just get in the car and tell that I want to go to this particular place.
Yes. So this would have seemed improbable 15 years ago, and today it is everyday. It's an everyday thing. Everybody seems to be using it. So I think we have to keep that in mind and be humble and not just throw away all this saying this is just fantasy and imagination, because many times we see that we are not discovering things, we are just rediscovering. All these things were very much available to our ancestors, and it is sad that we have forgotten all this. And when we are rediscovering, we are thinking that we are great, but we just realize it is better that we are humble to understand that these things have already been in existence. And as you rightly said, it requires training and practice to be able to use these mantras. And even when you use these mantras, it's not like it's available randomly. It has to be got from the deity itself. And therefore, sadhana and tapas is needed. And that's why Arjuna decides to go and acquire these weapons. He consoles his elder brother Yudhishthira by saying, "Don't worry, brother. You know, if I know that thoughts of the war, of an impending war, the possibility of the war, these are bothering you. In order to arm ourselves, you know, let me go and let me propitiate. We have got a lot of time in the exile. So let me utilize my time properly. I will propitiate the lords, the gods, and try to win as many celestial weapons as possible."
I mean, would the Kauravas would have ever thought of this? You know, they're sending them on exile, but actually it has given them the opportunity to really, you know, forge their power. Because in fact, in the 1 year of Ajnanavasa, they end up in the, I think, the kingdom of Virata, right?
Or kingdom of Virata, yes.
Virata. I mean, eventually he becomes one of the major allies for the Pandavas during the war. I mean, these are not things which the Kauravas really thought of. I think that is what happens, you know, when you talk of God's grace. Many times we go through life and say, you know, I'm praying to Swami, I'm a devotee of Swami, I do bhajans and seva, and why is this happening to me? I think there are some eventualities of life which God does not necessarily come and meddle with. But even as we go through that, He ensures that, you know, you meet the right people during the right times, and even through a negative process, you gain something positive at the end of it. I think that's the blessing of having the grace of God we are seeing through the Pandava's life. And probably you will notice these things only if you look at the story with a devotional bent of mind. I mean, if we constantly say that, how can we say the Pandavas benefited because they were always in exile, they always lost, they always were in the losing side. I mean, these are the finer details which we miss out. That Krishna, all through, like the episodes that we mentioned last time, even through a difficult time, you know, Durvasa, who came to curse, ends up giving the boon which was right opposite against what the curse which he wanted to give.
Exactly. It is at this point, I think we should reinforce this important distinction between karma tyaga and karma phala tyaga. You know, it is not as if when we surrender to God, it frees us from doing any action. We need not do anything, just sit. Because as you rightly said, this was an intense period for the Pandavas. When they have surrendered to Krishna, they actually worked more. But what they surrender is the expectation of fruits from the actions that they do. So they are not surrendering their actions. They continue to do their duties. They continue to work hard. It's just that they are not bothered about what the result turns out to be. And I think this lesson has been highlighted through a Chinna Katha that Swami narrates, which has been also enacted in Bhagwan's presence. Mm-hmm. Wherein, you know, I remember how during the drama, I think it was 1999, there was this scene that was supposed to be portrayed in the convocation drama. Mm-hmm. And the whole drama lasted 2 hours. This scene was 58 minutes. I remember this because we wanted to do the scene again when we were in our post-graduation. Okay. We wanted to depict the scene in Bhagwan's presence. So we thought we should allocate 10 minutes for this scene. We had no idea about the original timing. We said 10 minutes is good enough because our drama scenes typically are ranged between 5 to 6 minutes each scene. So we thought 10 minutes for this scene because it's so important. The wonderful thing is, okay, I'll come to that later. So we thought we'll allot 10 minutes, and that is when we thought, let us draw inspiration from the scene that was depicted and directed by Bhagwan himself in 1999. Mm-hmm. And when we watched the VHS cassette, we realized that it ran for 58 minutes. The beautiful thing is, the dialogues for the scene were written by Bhagwan. Right. And he also wrote poems for each of the Pandava brothers and Draupadi herself, and a poem for Krishna, which was in Telugu and which was sung. And Swami himself, you know, sat and ensured that the correct tune was being sung. And I remember, I think, Brother Ravi Kumar from the Super Speciality Hospital, mm-hmm. Swami was so, emphatic that each one has to be sung in a such a perfect manner in this kind of way only that Bhima, who has got a strong personality with a commanding kind of voice and attitude, he sings in one manner. Nakula, who is subservient to Yudhishthira, sings in one manner. Arjuna, who is having a lot of sorrow because of so many things, he sings in one manner. So everything Swami directed. So that is the beauty of this scene. And the story goes just like this. All the Pandava brothers gang up on the eldest. Gang up against the eldest, which is Dharmaraja, telling him, brother, all the while you have kept us silent. We wanted to rip apart the Kauravas. We wanted to tear them. We wanted to kill them. You kept us telling that dharma, dharma, this is dharma, this is the way to do dharma. And in the name of dharma, you have stopped us. What on earth has dharma given us? And each brother, in his own attitude, in his own logic, with his own words and emotions, starts piercing Yudhishthira. Saying that we were rich like this, we were doing this, we could feed millions, and today we are in a position where we can't feed our own wife. Like that, each one. And Yudhishthira is just ripped apart. He doesn't know what to do. He is torn apart, and one hand he is convinced that he did the right thing by following dharma, but on the other hand he is now being ripped apart by his own brothers, and in that situation Krishna drops in there. I think this is before they got their Akshay Patra and all that, So Krishna drops in there, and he takes a leaf and writes a message on the leaf, and he tells Yudhishthira, I'm slightly confused whether it happens at this point in time or it has happened before, where a message is written on the leaf and given to Yudhishthira and told that in the times of the greatest difficulty, read this, this will help you. So I don't know whether at that point in time Krishna arrives or it is given before. But I remember that Swami was so involved in this scene that Bhagwan materialized a little golden pen for Krishna to carry, for the boy acting as Krishna to carry, so that he will pull out this golden pen and write on that leaf. And I think after the drama, this boy returned back the pen to Swami and...
No, what happened was Swami asked him, when this scene was being conceptualized, Swami asked him, with what will you write? So there were many suggestions which were given, he breaks something from the tree and he writes on a leaf or something like that. And somebody suggested that probably he pulls out...
peacock feather.
Yeah, the feather or something, or probably some ornament which he's wearing, he can pull out and he can write with that. And then, typically Swami's face lit up with a mischievous smile and Swami said, I will give you something. And then he materialized this thing. It was, explained, it was a golden stylus.
Exactly, yes. Like the one we use on our mobile.
Describe it, right? It was a golden stylus and Swami said, you can keep it, in your, behind your ear, and you pull it out and write. And Swami immediately said, then be sure to be careful with it and give it back to me at the end of the drama. He said it has to be returned to me. So that was one of the...
That was the story of that. So Krishna writes this and gives, and Dharmaja feels that this is possibly the opportune moment for him to open and, read this message, because he is being torn apart now. And when he reads it, instantly he becomes calm. And, I remember this whole scene for 50 minutes is being built up for towards this moment. And everybody is so eager to know what is it that Krishna had written on the leaf. Luckily, it is revealed to everybody. And it's revealed in a dramatic fashion, actually. Right. Krishna has written, this too shall pass. Saying that we don't get too attached to any success or any failure, because all are nothing but passing clouds. Hold on to only that which is permanent. And I think this philosophy... It looks like just four words, but if we are able to really understand and practice it to even a little extent in our lives, we will see the contentment and peace in our life grow manifold. So after this, I remember that scene, Yudhishthira, Bhima comes and says, what are you reading? How does it solve this problem? And he again reels out all those things. And Yudhishthira says, Bhima, this too shall pass. And then Arjuna tells something. He says, Arjuna, this too shall pass. Then Nakula tells something, then he says, Nakula, this too shall pass. I remember, because there were only four words and four brothers, and how will you repeat the same thing? So dramatically they had said, each time you repeat it, give emphasis on different words. So first it was, this too shall pass. Then it was, this too shall pass. This too shall pass. And this too shall pass. Where you give emphasis on all the four words. So it was a nice thing, but so... This was the message that Krishna gave of surrender. So when you say surrender, it doesn't mean that you stop doing actions, you stop taking decisions. No. You put in your best effort. You take a decision or you act as if everything depends on you. But having done that, you just leave the result as if nothing depends on you. I think this is that kind of involvement without attachment. What that is the true meaning of surrender.
Absolutely. And as we can see, you know, during this period when they were in the forest, if we were to look at it in a very dispassionate manner, we would see that probably this was the happiest time in their life. I mean, as Swami has also said, you know, they were actually living very happily in the forest. They were spending time in each other's company, and also the Swami speaks about how they were being able to help the people around them in many, many ways. There are many episodes which come how they help the villagers around. And that was their nature, you know, an ability to express their nature of goodness uninhibitedly was given to them. And of course, this episode where Arjuna goes away to do his penance, and this is the time he literally becomes the hero that he is when he stands in the battlefield. You know, though he's a ace archer, though he's a great warrior, this is the period which actually made him stand apart from the rest of the Kauravas. Because even before the war, there is that small battle which happens at the end of the 13th year, where single-handedly actually Arjuna defeats the same greats of Drona and Bhishma and Karna, Duryodhana and all of them. And that is when really they realize that, you know, he has become someone who cannot be
rivaled. So Arjuna sets out actually, and he goes to this region called the Gandhamadana area. The Gandhamadana area, and I was just looking up on the internet to see if there is any indication as to where this Gandhamadana area comes. And there are a lot of references to Gandhamadana area.
Okay.
Apparently it is said that Lord Hanuman lives there permanently. Lord Hanuman is a Chiranjeevi, so he lives in the Gandhamadana mountain. Many things associated with it. One Gandhamadana mountain is supposed to be in Sri Lanka, the area where Hanuman landed when he went to Lanka. The other Gandhamadana mountain is, they say, little beyond Kailash. Since Arjuna is here trying to propitiate Lord Shiva, we will come to that later, and also seeing the region where Hastinapura is and where Indraprastha is, I am inclined to believe that possibly this Gandhamadana area is the one near the Mount Kailash.
Mm-hmm.
So the Himalayan snow peak mountain and pristine forest, even to this day it is like that, unexplored, untouched by man. So you can imagine in those days how it was. Nobody can go to such region. You have to be a valiant warrior and a phenomenal stamina person just to even go to such a place to do penance. Arjuna sets out to do penance there. What happens next is very interesting, but I think we'll come to that after this little break. So dear listeners, don't go anywhere. After the break, we'll go through the story of Arjuna's adventures at the Gandhamadana mountain.
Nandalala, Nandalala, daya karo Bhagavan. Nandalala, Nandalala, daya karo Bhagavan. भवसागर से पार उतारो भवसागर से पार उतारो कृपा करो भगवान tumhari sharan bin anath hai hum daya karo bhagwan kripa karo साईं कृपा करो भगवान नंदलाला नंदलाला दया करो भगवान सागर से पार उतारो दया करो भगवान कृपा करो भगवान कृपा करो भगवान नंदलाला नंदलाला दया करो
Welcome back, dear listeners. We're talking about that episode where Arjuna goes out to perform penance and gain the blessings of the various gods and deities in the form of weapons which can be later used in the eventuality of a war. And when he starts his penance, the first person to appear before him is his father, who's Lord Indra, as we know probably for those who are not sure, I mean, who are not clear of how he is the father, though he is actually a Pandava, or in that sense a Pandu Putra, in that sense, where Mother Kunti does this puja of worshipping any deity by chanting one particular shloka she gets from the Lord, the Sun God, right? Sun God is the one who gives
each
her.
One of the, actually, I think, I'm also not very clear, but a sage, whom she makes happy, the sage promises her mantras, right.
Exactly.
Chanting which from that particular deity she'll get a child.
Right, it's not the sun god, it's the sage. I think it's sage.
Vyasa, I don't know.
So we know the first deity that she propitiates is Lord Surya, through whom she gets Karna, but that was before she marries.
In fact, very important lesson there also. She has been given five mantras, and she has told that when you propitiate, you'll get a child. Now, even before marriage, she's doubting whether this will really happen or not. So that is why, as an experimental trial, she does Surya Mantra. And when she's not yet married, she gets a child.
And that's how she has to let go of that child. But then she prays to the Dharma Raja or Yama Dharma, and she gets Yudhishthira. She prays to Lord Indra, and she gets Arjuna.
Oh, Vayu, Bhima.
Vayu and Bhima. And the Ashwini Kumaras, and she gets Nakula and Sahadeva.
The twins.
Right. So in that sense, Lord Indra is the father of Arjuna. So he comes when he sees his son performing penance.
Prem, just for the sake of factual correctness, I also forgot. In fact, she doesn't get Nakula and Sahadeva, you know.
Yeah, correct. Yes. She doesn't get Nakula and Sahadeva. It's the mother Madri.
Madri. Because mother Madri is also childless. what happens again is a very interesting thing. It is said how Pandu
has a curse,
and that's another story. But Pandu dies actually without begetting any children. So she feels that the other wife, Madri, will not have any chance of getting a child. Therefore, she shares one mantra with her. But that mantra happens to be that of the Ashwini Kumaras, who are celestial twins.
Right.
And that's why she begets twins.
Right.
Nakula and Sahadeva. Yeah.
So Indra comes and gives this piece of advice to Arjuna that first and foremost he should propitiate Lord Shiva and gain from him what is referred to as the Pashupatastra, which is supposed to be the weapon of Lord Shiva. And that is how Arjuna starts worshipping Lord Shiva in pursuit of this particular weapon. And it is during this time that interesting episode happens, which Vyasa was referring to, where that the Pandavas have even locked horns in battle with the gods.
And it makes sense that he has to propitiate Shiva, because in the Trinity, Brahma is concerned with creation, Vishnu with preservation, and Shiva with destruction. Since the goal here actually is to destroy the Kauravas if a war happens to come across, I think it was an intelligent suggestion that he propitiate Shiva first and get his blessings, get his go-ahead. And Pashupatastra is supposed to be the most powerful one. There is the Brahmastra, the Vaishnavastra, and the Pashupatastra, each belonging to the three gods of the Trinity. So, he goes deeper into the Gandhamadana area and starts his penance for Lord Shiva. And after intense penance, it is said that Lord Shiva decides to bless him, but not before testing his resolve and testing his valor. And that's the reason Lord Shiva disguised as a hunter, a bhil. That's how Swami writes in that region. Even to this day in India, we have the tribe of bhils,
right,
who hunt animals with bows and arrows for their consumption, you know. So a bhil accompanied with his wife and the entire tribe, they come. But before that, what happens is, as Arjuna is sitting in meditation, his meditation is disturbed by the angry snort and grunt of a wild boar. And it looks like the boar is charging towards him, almost about to attack him. So immediately, in order to defend himself, Arjuna pulls out his bow and arrow. He pulls out his bow, takes the arrows, and he mounts it on the bow. He's about to shoot it. That is when he sees this bhil, his wife, and the entire tribe there. He realizes that it's not possibly the boar charging at him, but the boar that is trying to run away because it's being attacked by the bhils and his tribe. Therefore, you know, he realizes that they are on a hunt and it's escaping from the hunt, but whatever be the thing, he's going to be collateral damage, you know, because it's charging towards him. So he pulls out an arrow and he actually kills the boar. Not thinking it to be a big deal, you know, what is there? After all, if they want the boar, they can take the boar and go. I'm not interested in the boar, I'm just trying to protect myself. And he kills. But little does he know that this seemingly spontaneous action from him is going to land him into an argument and also big trouble.
Right, because, I mean, we don't know what are the rules of hunting in the forest region. Actually, that's what happens. Arjuna thinks that there's nothing wrong in him killing the boar. But this hunter and family, he comes and he takes serious offense to that. He says that this is a game that we have been chasing, that it is not right on your part to place your eye on it. No, he says that you cannot make it your target when we have been pursuing it with the entire group for so long. So this is how the argument starts, and then it comes to the point where the huntsman opens a challenge, throws a challenge at Arjuna and says that, you know, if you really consider yourself such a great man, and you must face me in a duel, and only then you can take away the boar. That's what actually it comes to. But Arjuna says, I'm not interested in the boar in that sense. But he's saying that, but still, you have made target what was my target, so you better face me in battle now.
In fact, Arjuna tries to tell that, see, I am here to propitiate Lord Shiva. I'm not interested in the boar. You can just take. I did it out of self-defense, you know. Because I'm actually not interested in the boar. And when he tells this, the Bill shouts back saying, I don't care what you came here for, I don't care whom you are adoring and all that, don't tell all those stories, you know, what you have done is a terrible sin and this is stupid on your part, you should not have done this, it looks like you have no idea what is rule, what is dharma, you have nothing, you know, he starts criticizing him. And I think more than what was the rule of hunting game in the forest, I think this kind of logically very weak argument was purposely picked up by Lord Shiva, because his objective was to instigate Arjuna. And that's exactly what happens. Arjuna is listening to this hunter talk like this, and in his mind he is contemplating, he's thinking, he doesn't know who I am, you know, that's why he's shouting like this. Does he know that he's talking to the Gandivadhari Arjuna, the one who Dhananjaya, the Falguna, the one who has fought Indra away, you know? It's amazing, you know, he's thinking all this, and so, you know, he tries to show a little humility and says that you calm down, you should not do this. But when he sees that the Bill is not relenting, he says, okay, fine then, you hunter, face me, you know, you please leave me because you have no idea of my capabilities. If you try to simply provoke me and have a fight, you will all just get decimated. Why don't you simply pick the boar and go about your way peacefully? And the Bill then speaks back saying that you are being so boastful. You think you can decimate us. I don't think you have the ability even to scratch one of us, and you talk like this. And all this is happening in the presence of a woman, you know. And I think that strikes at the manhood, possibly. It strikes at your manliness. And Arjuna says, okay, if it's a fight that you want, let's have it then. So he picks up and immediately releases an arrow. And Swami writes that arrow goes and it has that impact on the hunter what a needle would have on a rock. It just touches and falls off. And Arjuna releases another arrow, more arrow, the crescent shaped arrow, different arrows that he has got. He doesn't have any special weapons, potent weapons, but he has different tipped arrows. So a crescent shaped arrow, a trident shaped arrow, different kind of arrow he releases, but none of them make any dent on the hunter, and he's amazed because the hunter has not yet taken up arms. So having exhausted his arrows, he attacks the hunter with his bow, with his heavy Gandiva bow, you know, using it as a club. But again, no impact. Finally, he gets into a wrestling match, and in the wrestling match, he's not able to do anything to the hunter, but the hunter pins him down, thumps him, and holds him in such a manner that Arjuna starts spitting out blood. That is when he realizes that he is no match for this Bill.
No, many times when we listen to stories like this, especially of Arjuna and how he became egoistic, it's very easy for us to look at it and say, oh, here is a person who's getting egoistic. You know, I don't know about others, but I many times get this idea that we probably look at heroes like Arjuna a bit unfairly, thinking that we will never be like that. You know, that is how the idea comes from. No, I will not be like that. But the thing is, what a person is when he gets a certain power and certain authority or a certain talent or a certain fame and name, the way a person behaves like that, only a person who has that will know. A person who is a commoner like us would be it's very easy for us to comment that, oh, he is egoistic, oh, he is having this one. But there is no guarantee that we will not behave that way, if not worse, when we get into the same situation. And many times you see that, you know, in small things. I mean, even in the ashram you would see that, you know, when you walk around, somebody comes and stops you, or Sevadal stops you. Somewhere that ego will be there. You know, you have no idea who I am. I am a staff. You have no idea. I am a student. In some form it is there. I mean, in various levels it is there. In your corporate world, the corporate structure, it is there. Some form of hierarchy is there. Within a house, a father feels like that when a son does not give him respect. So in that sense, in many, many subtle ways it is there. It is quite understandable that someone, I'm not saying it is justified, but it is understandable that somebody of the stature of Arjuna does give himself up, I mean, unwillingly, of course, to sometimes the ego getting risen like that. And for Arjuna, in Arjuna's case, it happens multiple times. Probably to tell us that this is where all of us stand, and we can see our own reflection in a character like Arjuna.
Absolutely. You know, you reminded me of my own personal experience. It often happens, as you said, whenever Swami gives examples of the pride that Arjuna had, the pride that anybody had, and how God humbled them, we always tend to look down on them at that point in time and they see, so he was also smitten by the ego bug, he was also smitten by, bitten by the pride bug or the jealousy bug. And What we don't realize is, in another discourse, Bhagavan has said, you know, Duryodhana had only one fault, which is lobha, greed. And that greed brought his downfall. Ravana had only one fault, which is kama, desire. That desire brought his downfall. And when Swami criticizes them, you know, we also look down upon Duryodhana. Why Duryodhana? We are looking down upon Arjuna also, you know, when we do this. But Swami in that discourse mentioned that just imagine with one negative thing they had a downfall. Imagine all of you have all the six. Kama, Krodha, Lobha, Moha, Mada, Matsarya. Okay? So we are struck by all that. Duryodhana didn't have the weakness of Kama at all. No, you don't see him, you know, coveting others' wives at all. Nothing, no problem like that. In the same way, you will not see Ravana being greedy at all. But when we examine our own thing, anger, greed, lust, we have traces of everything. And yet, in these instances when Arjuna is mentioned, we think that, you know, possibly we won't be like that. I remember when Swami would often narrate the story of how Krishna and Arjuna are walking, and I think I've narrated this multiple times, but I love to show this because it makes us realize how naive we are being. Krishna points out to a bird in the sky and says it's an eagle, and Arjuna agrees. He says, no, it's a peacock. He agrees. He says, no, it's a parrot. It's a crow. And, you know, Swami would often change the birds, you know, for variety's sake possibly, or to make the narrative interesting. But whatever bird Krishna says, Arjuna agrees that that is the bird. And Krishna says, oh Arjuna, are you blind? What you are simply saying yes to whatever I say. Arjuna says, Lord, I'd rather trust your word than my own vision. Because your word will come true, my vision might cheat me. And whenever Swami would narrate this, I would feel that, Swami, that's not the greatness of Arjuna. If you tell anything, all of us also accept it, you know. That's what I used to think. Which is not the case. Because how many times Swami tells, you are divine, I am divine. But have we accepted it? We have not. Why go to that level? When I was thinking like this, I got not one but two opportunities where I could see where I stand vis-a-vis Arjuna.
Mm-hmm.
Swami narrated in Tri Vrindavan once more this very same story, you know, of Krishna and Arjuna. And I had this habit of making notes of Swami's discourses. But whenever Swami comes to a story, that is the point where I stop making notes and spend the time looking at Swami. Because I would always feel that during the discourse I am so busy making notes, I am not able to look at Swami. But I didn't want to give up making notes. But when he tells the story like, now Krishna and Arjuna walking, I know the story. So I'll just write Krishna Arjuna story and start looking at Swami. So same thing I did. And again Swami, you know, as I said, every time he changes the birds, he makes it eagle, he makes it pigeon. And I used to feel that I'm also surrendering like Arjuna. Because Swami, doesn't matter whichever bird you tell. Whatever bird you tell, that's what it is. I thought that is surrender and acceptance. But that day, to my shock, Swami said, Krishna pointed to the sky and said, look Arjuna, there's a lion. I said, oh my God, Swami, what lion? How can you tell lion, Swami? Means I understand your creativity in changing the birds from peacock to pigeon to whatever. But lion? I thought, you know, a slip of the tongue, but fine, Swami will cover it up. Swami then said, Arjuna agreed and said, yes, it's a lion. Then Krishna said, no Arjuna, it's a horse. I said, oh my God, Swami, what are you doing? Dog, lion, horse, they don't fly. You know, but Bhagavan went about like that and ended the story and continued the discourse, and it ended. Later on in retrospect, I realized that I was thinking that I am having the same surrender like Arjuna, nothing special in Arjuna. And here was one opportunity where Swami said, horse and lion, and I was not ready to accept it. You know, I was not ready to accept it. It is so much greater on Arjuna's part because Arjuna can actually see it with his eyes. Here I am not able to see it. I am just listening to a narrative. And yet I am not ready to agree to Swami. I am so limited. I am saying, Swami, if you change the birds, I am ready to accept. But if you make it animal, animals don't fly. Means if my surrender was true, if Swami is narrating the story and Swami says, he said, look, there's a Ford Endeavor car there. And Arjuna said, yes. I must write down that with the great acceptance. That is what it is. That was one occasion. Another occasion, you know, Swami was watching through photos that we were showing on a screen. And I happened to show a photograph of Swami's residence silhouetted against the sun. Mm-hmm. So the entire sky was orange and Swami's residence was silhouetted. It was black. So Swami looked and Swami said, wow, what a lovely moon it is. No, I said, no Swami, that's the sun. Swami said, no, that is the moon. I said, no Swami, in my mind I'm thinking I took the photo, so it's the sun. Then Swami is giving logic so sweetly. Swami is saying, see, that whole building is dark. It is night time only, that's why it is dark, that's why I am saying it is a moon. I am thinking in my mind, no Swami, my exposure settings was to the sun, and you know how to explain all that photographic term to Swami, I thought. So I said, see Swami, see the background is fully orange. If it is moon, it has to be white, right? It is orange, so therefore it is the sun. Swami, I am telling you it is the sun. And Swami said, oh, okay, whatever you say. And then, you know, the session went on and different things happened. Swami interacted with many people. Again, in retrospect, I realized here was another opportunity where I could have, like Arjuna, where I could have told, yes, Lord, whatever you say. But instead, what did I do? I made the Lord say, yes, okay, whatever you say. That is when I realized how flimsy we are, when how callous we are being when we think that, you know, Arjuna's surrender is not, Arjuna is egoistic, Arjuna falls. It's not right to look down upon him like that.
In many, many ways, Swami would put us through this, not because, you know, to put us in our place or make us feel low about ourselves, but the idea of going through these epics is to see that these are the flaws that human nature is capable of or is given to, and to be cautious of that and correct ourselves. But the moment we get to the judgmental mode, we say, oh, Arjuna was egoistic. Oh, Bhima was given to temper. Oh, Durvasa was short-tempered. But we forget the lesson in that. I remember another student telling that, you know, Swami would come and pick up these primary school kids and ask them, where are you from? Hmm. And they would say that, Swami, we are from Swami. And Swami will be so proud of that, and Swami will tell the VIP, see how nicely this boy is answering. Apparently, one particular scene like that was happening. There were two boys who were sitting and seeing this. And one of the boys, he nudged the other guy and he said, no, why is Swami making such a big thing about it? If Swami asks me also, I'll tell the same thing. You know, what's so great in that reply that the little kid is giving, that Swami is celebrating it so much? And I don't recall the details, but he said in the next 48 hours or so, three times Swami picked up this boy who made that comment. And on various occasions, Swami asked him, where do you come from? And each time he mentioned the place where he came from. And just after mentioning, he realized that, oh God, I told Swami, I made this comment. You know, very, very randomly, you know, suddenly Swami will pick him up from the crowd and say, where are you coming from? Or Swami will be talking about something related to the place and ask him, where are you coming from? Where every time he ended up saying the name of the place. I mean, this is just so that we become vigilant as, you know, aspirants in the path.
You know, Bhagwan points it out in so many ways. I narrated that episode of the silhouetted residence building. Again, as you said, 48 hours. Within that time, I remember it was in Hadshi that this happened. So in Hadshi, the bhajan was being sung, and you know, we joined in the bhajan, this Brahmanda Nayaka Baba. Mm-hmm. And you know, we were singing, Chand aur Suraj Tumne Banai. And I was thinking, what a stupid thing I did. Here I am saying, you are the creator of the sun and the moon. And I am trying to tell him the distinction between, and this is not the sun, this is the moon. See, this is what I think happens when we are not in that constant awareness. Forget constant integrated awareness. I think before going to constant integrated awareness, I think we have to move into the level of at least constant awareness. Just being aware of whose presence we are in. It's a great challenge, and that is why when we see those rare occasions, or multiple occasions it might be, Arjuna faltered possibly 15 times in his life. But I think I falter on that front 15 times in a day. So, as you rightly said, we should look at these episodes where Arjuna or others whomever falter, realizing that even a person of the stature of Arjuna can fall to such a thing. That is the amount of vigilance that we need. I think that is a lesson we should derive.
And so beautifully, you know, the whole thing starts with Arjuna saying that, you know, whom do you think you're challenging? You know, this is the great Arjuna, this is this great Pandava that you're trying to battle against. But the moment he realizes that all his talent is nothing in front of a mere huntsman, and then Swami says that after trying to attack him with the bow, and then, after trying to attack him with the arrows and then the bow, he finally gets into a wrestling bout, literally catching each other and trying to overpower one another. And that's when this huntsman holds Arjuna, locks Arjuna in a grip which is so strong that Arjuna starts spitting out blood. And that is when Arjuna starts thinking of Krishna and calls out to Krishna to come and help him, right? And this is again a typical thing of all of us. You know, we go through everyday life with a thing, with the idea that, Swami, these problems I can handle. The bigger problems I'll turn to you. You know, a class test I can handle, but if it's a public exam, then I'll need your help. Right? Or it's a small problem within the house, I can handle it. But if it's a serious medical issue, then I'll turn to God. And this is where we literally do that mistake of, it is important to constantly think of God and say, even when you're doing what you're supposed to do. I mean, it's not like every time you call out to God and then you keep quiet. But even in the process of doing what you're supposed to do, you pray to God. It's not doing the best and then leaving the rest to God. I mean, I feel there is some mistake in that statement. You always give up to God, but you do what you're supposed to do. I think that is what is important.
Yeah, doing your best in terms of putting the best efforts, but always with the awareness that it is the Lord who gives success or defeat, and it's got nothing to do. Because see, here also, the other lesson that we can draw here is commonly in our lives, one you said is we think that little problems we'll solve, bigger problems you take care. As if like God, you know, I don't want to bother you with these little things. Right. Okay, and the other thing, mistake we make here is thinking that these are little things that I can manage.
I have the talent to.
Both are mistaken. Recently I was speaking to a fellow alumnus, Vineet Basutia, and he was saying how it was when, you know, Swami had told him to do PhD, he was doing PhD here, and in the summer they were in Vrindavan, and Swami suddenly had called all these research scholars and teachers and told them to keep a secret, which was that the next day they would be going to Nagarhole, forest region in the border of Karnataka and Tamil Nadu, I think. And forest lodge, we'll go and see elephants and all that. So it was a secret trip. But Vineet at that time was suffering from a lot of fever and, you know, cold and vomiting, multiple problems, feeling giddy. And those were the days when Swami had given him the opportunity to regularly talk with Swami. But he said that not once he mentioned to Swami. Now, there are different reasons why people don't mention. One reason people don't mention is because they think, you know, Swami knows everything, what is the need for me to tell? That is fine. But what was Vineet's line of thinking was, everybody around the world keep burdening Swami with their troubles. Why should I add my troubles to Swami? It's a noble thought in a normal sense, but if you see, that is also coming from the same kind of ego, thinking that these kind of sickness is enough. Probably if I had cancer, I will never think, why should I burden Swami with my problem? I'll go and tell Swami I've got cancer. But if I've got fever, I think, you know, fever I'll manage. Why should I tell Swami? So, he thought like that and he kept it a secret from Swami. And even when they went to Nagarhole, he says that, man, this is a time when everybody will try to get the maximum out of Swami because it's only a small group around Swami. But I was keeping away from Swami because I didn't want Swami to notice me and think that I'm sick. Swami tells us that Chinnakatha of a person who gets into the train and says, train is carrying so many people, why should I burden it with my luggage? I'll carry my luggage on my head. You don't realize that your head is also being carried by the train and the luggage is again being carried by the train. But that day, he says that Swami himself called, asked for him, and then publicly in front of everyone said, this boy is trying to hide from me. Chupta hai. He doesn't tell me that he is not feeling well. He thinks Swami doesn't know. And Swami materialized Vibhuti, put it in his mouth, took his own tumbler, silver tumbler, and fed him water from that. And Vineet says that within 10 minutes of that, what he had been suffering from almost 5 days, in a matter of 10 minutes, everything went. He sweated profusely and all the fever was gone, his giddiness was gone, his strength returned. And he said, I felt so foolish. And he said that, I realize today that it's ego on our part to think that these are little problems I'll manage. Let me not burden the Lord. No, the Lord carries the whole universal burden, whether you willingly give it or not. So, it's a very important thing to keep in mind. One is, don't think that this is small, that I will manage, I'm having the strength to manage. It is too small for God. Other thing, when things are going well, you think that I am doing it. That's what Arjuna said. You have no idea whom you are going to fight with. At that point in time, he never thought telling the bhil that you have, telling the hunter that you have no idea whom you are going to fight with. You are going to fight with a person who has the backing of Krishna. I think probably if he had said that, things would have been different.
Absolutely. Because he thought that you are fighting with Arjuna. And you know, that is the difference. You know, when we spoke about the Navya, the Bhakti, and when we spoke about Dasyam, we spoke of this. why is Hanuman given as an example for Dasyam? In fact, Hanuman can be given as an example for every one of those Navaita Bhakti, because he really fits into every one of them. He's a scholar, he's a person, I mean, we've spoken of that. Every time you sing the name of the Lord of Rama, he's present, because which means that he is a devotee who practices Shravanam. And we always speak of him as somebody who is constantly repeating the name of the Lord. So he stands for Kirtanam and Namasmaranam and all of that. But why is he given as an example of Dasyam? Is, you know, when Ravana asks him, who are you? He says, I am the Dasa of Lord Rama. He says, that is my identity and that is my qualification. You know, that is where a Dasa stands. And Arjuna was missing in that, in this particular episode, because he said, I am Arjuna. You are standing against the great Arjuna, not Arjuna who has the backing of Lord Krishna, as you beautifully said. And that is where Arjuna is missing. And this point where he finds that the person who he is fighting against seems to be more powerful than him.
Lord Krishna himself, he thinks.
Right. And now he says, now he turns to Lord Krishna and says, no, probably only Krishna can save me now.
He as I said, he Swami writes that he thinks possibly this is only Krishna in another
Krishna
form.
Krishna himself has come
to teach me a lesson. And he surrenders. And the beautiful thing is, the moment he surrenders to Krishna, before him is not a hunter and his wife and the tribe, but Lord Shiva, Mother Parvati with all the Ganas. And it is a celestial sight, and Arjuna is thrilled and he prostrates. He says, oh Lord, it is you whom I have been trying to propitiate. I have been trying to reach you and you have reached out to me. I am so grateful. And he falls at the feet of Lord Shiva and Parvati.
Right. And the divine couple bless him, and he is also given that Pashpatastra at this point. And this is one of the most important weapons that he earns through this period. And of course, this was the episode which was narrated by Vyasa to Parikshit.
Don't think that your grandfather was wrong in fighting the Lord. You know, possibly some of the feelings and thoughts that came through were like that, but as a Kshatriya, his duty is to fight. And he therefore fought even Lord Shiva himself. And you know, later on during the Bhagavad Gita also, this is what Krishna precisely reminds Arjuna also, that your kartavya, your duty as a Kshatriya is to fight. And that is shown in such a beautiful manner here by Arjuna, because as a Kshatriya, he is ready even to take on God. As we emphasized during the narration, it's not about not fighting. It's not that he should not have fought Shiva. It's about the attitude with which he fights Shiva. Whenever he fights whomever it is, whether it is Shiva or whether it is some lesser soldier, he should never think that this is a soldier and I can beat him. This is Shiva, Lord Krishna, I need your help. We should always remember that whatever I am able to do, the greatest thing that I am able to achieve is all because of Lord's backing to me. It's not that, Lord, this is a challenge in my life, I need you here. These things I can manage on my own. Yeah, without that. So the attitude was wrong, but what action he did was perfectly right. And this is what Vyasa is also praising to Parikshit. And even as he praises this, he says that it is not just in this circumstance. In every battle of life that the Pandavas faced, that your grand uncles faced, Krishna was there to help them. And Parikshit again looks at this as an opportunity to pull out more stories. He says, wow, I would like to know more about those. But I think we will come to some more of those after this little break. We will take a break and come back within the next three minutes.
Bhajamana Govinda Narayanam Smaramanasa Vasudeva Sutam Bhajamana Govinda Narayanam Smaramanasa Vasudeva Sutam Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Vrindavana Sanchara Paramahi Giridhari, He Suridas Priyashama Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Vrindavana Sanchara Paramahi Giridhari, He Suridas Priyashama Madhuvana Sanchari, Leela Dhari Madhuvana Sanchari, Leela Dhari Tarseye Nayana Avaja Giridhari Madhuvana Sanchari, Leela Dhari Maanguna Main Tujhse
मोती कीमत इनकी होती है छोटी मांगू तुझी को तुझसे ही क्योंकि मांगू तुझी को तुझसे ही क्योंकि तू ही तो है मेरे जीवन की ज्योति तू ही तो है मेरे जीवन की ज्योति
हरे कृष्णा वृंदावन संचारा भरवारी गिरिधारी हे सूरदास प्रिय श्यामा हरे कृष्णा वृंदावन संचारा भरवारी गिरिधारी हे सूरदास प्रिय श्यामा
कवितल कंदनी काव्यमा पदमुलु रायनी पद्यमा कवितल कंदनी काव्यमा पदमुलु रायनी पद्यमा स्वरमुलु पाडनी रागमा स्वरमुलु पाडनी रागमा मधुरिमके माधुर्यमा मधुरिमके माधुर्यमा करुणतो निंडिना संग्रमा प्रेमतो पंदिना बंधमा गम्यमु चेर्चे मार्गमा अंदरिलो चैतन्यमा अंदरिलो
हरे कृष्णा वृंदावन संचारा भरवारी गिरिधारी हे सूरदास प्रिय श्यामा हरे कृष्णा वृंदावन संचारा भरवारी गिरिधारी हे सूरदास प्रिय श्यामा
वेलकम बैक डियर लिसनर्स We were talking about the episode where Arjuna goes on to win the weapon from Lord Shiva through that episode where Lord Shiva and Parvati come to test him. Thereon, Vyasa explains how Krishna was with the Pandavas through the thick and thin of life because after this, the 12 years of the Vanavasa has completed, the 1 year of living incognito, what we mentioned, where the Pandavas take different roles in the kingdom of Virata, where Dharmaraja becomes the minister counsel for the king. Arjuna becomes a teacher of dance and music to the princess. And Bhima becomes the cook in the royal kitchen. And I think Draupadi becomes the chief maids woman for the queen. And
and they all take different names. I remember Yudhishthira becomes Kanka and Bhima becomes Vallabha. And Draupadi becomes Sairendri.
Mm-hmm.
And
Arjuna, I forgot the...
Yes, Brihannala.
Brihannala.
He becomes
right.
Brihannala. And again, that is an interesting episode because we spoke of the Pashupatastra. After that, he goes about winning many celestial weapons from many gods. He spends a lot of time in the kingdom of his father, that is Indra. And in Indra Loka, it is said that one of those celestial dancers among Ramba, Urvashi, Menaka and Tilottama. I don't know, I think it is Urvashi or Menaka. From whom Arjuna is learning dance. She actually falls in love with Arjuna and Arjuna says that you are my teacher, I can't, you know, marry you. And she pronounces a curse that Arjuna will have to spend 1 year on 1 year of his life as a eunuch.
Actually, she curses that you will become a eunuch. You know, you are not able to respond to a woman's feelings. And I mean, even worse, you're calling me a mother, which is, she says, completely unacceptable. And she says that you will become a eunuch. But as many of the people who curse in our mythology, she immediately realizes that it's a mistake. That in fact, he is being honorable and she is, punishing him for that. So when, I think this is expressed to Lord Indra, it is suggested that she modifies the curse that it becomes just for 1 year so that it can be useful to him.
During that time of incognito. So therefore he is the dance teacher for all the princesses and the other royal women in Virata's kingdom. And this is how they are staying for 1 year. I think it's at this point in time, for some reason, the evil Kichaka comes to the kingdom of Virata, and he happens to lay his eyes upon Sairendri, that is Draupadi in disguise actually.
Right.
He tries to trouble her, and Draupadi complains to the cook, which is Vallabha, Bhima, and Bhima rips apart and kills Kichaka. That is when, you know, news spreads like wildfire, because Kichaka is a very, very powerful person, and the Kauravas think that this is possibly...
Actually, Kichaka is also a wrestler who is supposed... I think the name that he has is only two people can defeat him. Because there are only two wrestlers who can match his might. Nobody else can. One is Duryodhana and the other is...
Yes, of course, maybe Balrama also, because Balrama is a coach for Duryodhana and Bhima. But that's it. So Duryodhana is very sure that he was not there who killed Kichaka. Yeah. And if Kichaka is killed, Bhima must be living there. And if Bhima is there, the rest of the Pandavas also must be there. And they think that this is a good opportunity for us to, you know, discover the Pandavas. Because I think just a day or two are left. And if they discover the Pandavas by then the Pandavas will have to repeat the cycle of 12 years of exile and 1 year of another living in incognito. And therefore the Kauravas attack with all their might. And the Pandavas wait. Virata seems to be losing. And they wait till the Ajnatvasa elapses. And it's almost like when the clock strikes 12 and the Ajnatavasa is complete, all of a sudden Kanka, the person who is the main courtier, a minister kind of person for Virata, tells that, don't worry, O king, you know, there are my brothers who can take care. In fact, an interesting episode happens here. King Virata's son is also, his name is also Sahadeva, I think, Sahadeva.
Mm-hmm.
He says that, nothing to worry, I will defeat everybody. So, instead of directly telling the king that my brothers are there to take care now that the Ajnatvasa is over, Kanka reveals it in a very interesting manner. He tells, Lord, if you don't, king, if you don't mind, that Brihannala who is teaching dance, she is also an excellent charioteer. So why don't you send her as the charioteer for your son Sahadeva as he goes to defeat them? And so because he has won the trust of the king so much,
right,
Virata agrees to do that, and Brihannala therefore becomes a charioteer and goes. And when Sahadeva sees, this is not the Pandava Sahadeva, this is Sahadeva the son of Virata. When he sees the might of the Kauravas, he starts trembling there. In fact, he gets on from the chariot and starts running.
He's supposed to be a very young boy, he's
yes,
merely in his teens.
Teens, but he's got that, I will do it kind of, you know, that kind of pride. And Arjuna at that time, because it's Brihannala is Arjuna, he realizes because he sees that his 1 year is over, the curse has been completed. He gets down from the chariot and he tells, you don't worry. You just sit and take care of the chariot. You know, you be the charioteer and just watch the show. And that's what happened. That is what you were referring to when Arjuna single-handedly thrashes all the Kauravas. And the Kauravas say that this is Arjuna. And therefore they say, we have identified you. And so you must go back into exile. But the Pandavas don't agree because they say that the time is over now. You know, it's over. And that is where the debate starts, whether the time of Ajnatvasa was over or not. It's a very, very flimsy thing. Don't know who is right or wrong, but going by the way things have happened so far, definitely the Pandavas are right.
In fact, it has been proven. All the Purohits of the Kaurava court come and say that it is a fact that 1 year has elapsed. And it is accepted by Bhishma, it is accepted by Kripacharya and Drona, but only the Kauravas refuse to accept that. And led by Shakuni, of course.
Duryodhana is fed by Shakuni and he's not ready to accept it. And that is when the first talks of war begin. You know, it looks like there's no other way to get it back. And war seems to be the inevitable choice that they have to make. But it's amazing how when the Pandavas, you know, after having gone through all this, now they're coming to ask for what is rightfully theirs. Even at that time, they're being denied. So now Bhima, Arjuna, they're all just thirsting to get at the throats of the Pandavas, of the Kauravas probably. And at this point in time, Krishna comes and tells, you know what? Let's try for peace. He says, let me go as a messenger of peace. And it's amazing. It's actually a tribute to the faith and surrender of the Pandavas, that they are able to keep their emotions in check, and they say, Lord, if you say that we should try for peace, we should try for peace. And Krishna actually, see, that is what the Lord does. Swami says, I am Dasanudasa, I am your servant. You know, there have been many occasions when Swami has asked the student, what is it that you want to do? And he says, Swami, whatever you say. And Swami has replied back saying, no, whatever you say, because I am your servant, you know. And that is really the truth. And that is what Krishna does. Krishna has become a charioteer for the Pandavas. He becomes the emissary of peace. He becomes a messenger. And in fact, he goes to the Kaurava court. This episode again is not narrated in the Bhagavata Vahini as such, but Swami has immortalized it multiple times by naming this episode as the Shri Krishna Rayabharam.
Right. In fact, I think a couple of years back we had done a satsang on one particular beautiful discourse that Swami gives in the Samukos. Is Arjuna a warmonger or was he after peace?
Is Krishna a warmonger?
Sorry, is Krishna a warmonger or was he after peace? And I think in that we had extensively spoken about this particular episode and how actually Krishna followed the dharmic strategy, if you could put it that way, of what we call,
Samadana Beda Danda.
You know, how in this stage it was meant to go for peace talks and he said, let's go for peace. In fact, there is that beautiful episode, and I don't know whether it is written in the Bhagavatam or it was written by some commentators who wrote about it, where, you know, Draupadi comes and tells Krishna, you know, how can you talk about peace? What about all the vows that I've taken? My hair is still unbraided and I've told that I should see the death of so-and-so. You know, how would all that happen? And then Krishna beautifully says, you know, do you realize what would be the catastrophe which will follow a war? You know, how many people will be widowed and how many mothers will lose their children? If, in you know, the price that you have to pay for so many people being saved is your dishonor, I think you should be ready to do that. This is something which Krishna tells Draupadi and convinces her. And of course, back of his mind, he'll know that this is not going to happen. There's definitely going to be a war. But when we go through life, we go through with the idea that we don't know what the eventuality is going to be. We don't know what is the future going to be. So in each moment, our attitude should be colored by what is the right thing I'm supposed to do at this point in time. And that again explains what Krishna will tell Arjuna later in the battlefield. Probably we'll come to that later. But at this point, Krishna clearly says that you have to go for peace because that's the right thing to do now. And he says, I am ready to be the broker of peace. I am ready to be the messenger of peace. That's what it means. You know, Krishna Raya Bharam, he says, that I will take the burden of peace and I will speak on your behalf.
Another beautiful thing from this whole episode of Raya Bharam is, we often think that it is the weak that seek peace. You know, I can't beat this guy, so let me make peace with him. But Krishna sets a new precedent for all of us. He says that it is the strong that must seek peace. War must be the last resort, if nothing else works. And it is a strong, I think in today's world, this message we need a lot. Because whenever we see any kind of peace, peace just becomes absence of war and humiliation of the loser. That's how it is. That has been the cause for the First World War. That has been the cause for the Second World War. The way Germany was humiliated, right. It led to the, you know, because today's strong man will be tomorrow's weak man. They say, respect and treat with reverence everybody whom you meet on your way to the top, because those are the same people you will meet on your way down also. And Krishna shows here that it is the strong that must seek peace. It is not the weak who should seek peace because they are unable. The strong are able. If it makes more sense and it gives so much of dignity to it, you know. If I want, I can crush you. But I don't want to crush you because I seek peace. It is the strong that must seek peace, because here Krishna knows. And the Pandavas also know, with Krishna backing them, they have gone through so much in the last 14 years. They know that this war is not going to be any problem at all. Because with Krishna by their side, victory is already written. That's what Krishna tells later to Arjuna also, that Arjuna, I have already killed all these people. They are already dead. You just have to, you know, go through the motions. So that is the kind of force they have on their side. And Krishna is setting a precedent saying, when you are the mighty, you have to take the first step and say you want peace. And war has to be the last resort.
Right, and that is how he goes as the peace emissary. And, you know, we've spoken about that episode extensively, where, you know, Krishna even offers that to the Kaurava, saying that you don't have to give us the kingdom, you don't have to give Indraprastha, you give 5 villages, and I give you the word that even this is will be acceptable to the Pandavas. What is acceptable to me is acceptable to the Pandavas. I mean that probably shows the kind of confidence that Krishna had on the Pandavas. I think that is something which we all have to reach. You know, we having confidence in the Lord is probably the most logical thing, because there is one person we can trust and he is Swami. But if Swami can have the confidence in us, you know, I will tell and this person will accept it. I think that is the state we all have to strive and reach. I recall one of our lecturers telling that, you know, one day Swami calls him inside the interview room and tells him, he had already taken up a job as a lecturer and he was teaching. Mm-hmm. And Swami suddenly asked him, will you be prepared to go and join for research in the Prashant Nilayam campus? So this lecturer said, Swami, why are you asking me? If you say go, I'm going to go. You know, why should you ask me whether I'll be interested or not? And the immediate response that Swami gave was, I knew you were going to tell this, because that is why I've already sent your application. I've already told the Vice Chancellor that I'm sending this fellow for research. And wow. He said, you know, that is the confidence that we need to earn. That Swami should be able to tell on your behalf without having to consult you. And that means Swami has confidence that what I say, he will follow. And I think that is probably the greatest stamp the Pandavas got. Where in the Kaurava court, Krishna said, you give me this deal, be sure that this is what is okay for me is okay for the Pandavas.
And on that note, dear listeners, we shall bring our satsang this week to a close. The next fortnight, we will be going back to the theme of the mind, its mysteries, the enigma of the mind, the control of the mind. That is what we had initiated. The next fortnight, we will deal with that. And after that, return back to the fortnight of the Bhagavata Vahini. So, till then, see you next week, same time, on a different topic. Hope you enjoyed the satsang. As always, you can send in your feedback to listener@radiosai.org. All your messages reach us and they help us in making the satsangs more useful and more enriched, because rather than the thoughts and feelings of two of us here, it would be amazing to get the thoughts and feelings of everyone from across the globe. We leave you with a song, on the other side of which will be Brother Chandu's segment, Love to Love. So, Sai Ram, have a wonderful week ahead. A holy Thursday wish to all of you.
Krishna Govinda Hare Murare, Sai Nath Narayana Vasudeva. Hey Krishna Govinda Hare Murare, Sai Nath Narayana Vasudeva. गिनती हमारी सुन ले ओ साई, आए हैं हम तो दर पे ओ बनवारी. हे कृष्ण गोविंद हरे मुरारे, साई नाथ नारायण वासुदेवा. मथुरा मेरी आंखों में हो, वो द्वारका की मन में छवि, एक वृंदावन मेरी सांसों में हो, एक वृंदावन मेरी सांसों में हो. हे कृष्ण गोविंद हरे मुरारे, साई नाथ नारायण वासुदेवा. हे कृष्ण गोविंद हरे मुरारे, साई नाथ नारायण वासुदेवा. विनती हमारी सुन ले ओ साई, आए हैं हम तो दर पे तेरे ओ बनवारी. हे कृष्ण गोविंद हरे मुरारे, साई नाथ नारायण वासुदेवा. कृपा हम पे करो रंग में तेरे रंग जाए हम भूल से भी ना तुझको प्रभु दिल से कभी बिसराए हम दिल से कभी बिसराए हम हे कृष्ण गोविंद हरे मुरारे साईनाथ नारायण वासुदेवा हे कृष्ण गोविंद हरे मुरारे साईनाथ नारायण वासुदेवा विनती हमारी सुनने ओ साई आए हैं हम तो दर पे तेरे ओ बनवारी हे कृष्ण गोविंद हरे मुरारे साईनाथ नारायण वासुदेवा हे कृष्ण गोविंद हरे मुरारे साईनाथ नारायण वासुदेवा।